Ancient Warfare, Battle of Marathon Through the Eyes of Four Historians, Part 4, How the Greeks Won. Now, this is the final part of this series, Marathon Through Various Historians' Eyes. So let's look as far as this topic is concerned with points of agreement. Mr. Billows, in the Marathon, How One Battle Changed Western Civ, 2010, and Lacey, The First Clash, The Miraculous Greek Victory at Marathon and Its Impact on Western Civilization, 2011, and Krentz's The Battle of Marathon in 2010. Well, they all agree, that the Persian cavalry did not affect the battle's outcome, which is pretty obvious since they're barely mentioned, and it was determined strictly by infantry, which of course gave the advantage to the Greeks since they have heavy infantry. The Persian infantry is not designed the same way. We've talked about that. The Greeks successfully ran through the storm of Persian arrows. Well, they had better armor and weak Persian bow-penetrating fire, which we've seen from some of the other podcasts or listened to. The Greeks, of course, had some special advantages. They were defending their own land, which, of course, they knew intimately. And they're, of course, defending their families. They have superior armor. They have superior training. This Persian army that landed and fought at Marathon was not the highest quality that the Persians had available to them, particularly their infantry. This is not anywhere like the army that Xerxes is going to bring in during the Second Persian War. And, of course, that was to be expected. It's a different style, and the Persians were well aware of that as well. They have seen what the Greeks had worn. Now we have training. Now it isn't to say the Persians didn't have training. It's just that the training of the Greeks is probably much more demanding, in that they're going to be running a lot of the events in the Olympics were run in armor in some cases. You certainly can't just walk people out and do the phalanx formation without some practice. We certainly don't believe that other Greek city-states trained to the level that the Spartans did, but they certainly trained enough that the Spartans had some competition, particularly from Athens and other places. And of course, the weapons that the Greeks had were equal to and superior, particularly the dory, the spear, which was an inch in diameter and longer and weighted. That really helped out, and we've looked at that as well. Now, the differences. To the extent which the Greek commanders anticipated exactly how the battle would go. Now, this is a question that every general deals with. You plan on how the battle should go, and then you have to make adjustments on the way the battle went. So, I'm going to say, since things turned out well, it makes it look like the Greek commanders really knew what they were doing. They may have made some adjustments during the battle that give that impression. Now, Billows says that Miltiades developed a uniquely innovative and complex battle plan. He deployed his troops to match the length of the Persians. Well, they did that at the Battle of Ephesus, and it didn't do them any well because they weakened their lines too much. Here they had enough men to keep the strength of the line. To do that, the Greek left and the right wings remained as a standard 8-man-deep formation, but the center was thinned to just 4-man-deep. Okay, well, that would obviously, with a weakened center, would mean that any attack would probably push them back, which, of course, would allow the other two flanks to envelop them. So that's part of the process as well. The battle went as planned, according to Billows. The Greek wings routed their Persian counterparts and then turned to help their center. When the Persians realized that their flanks were turned, they broke and headed for their ships. So that's a plus side. Now let's look at Lacy. Now Lacy's an army veteran. Now he credits Callimachus rather than Miltiades with the strategy. He also believed that the Greeks had a novel as well as a brilliant plan to weaken the center and bring everybody in, something that's usually credited with, of course, Hannibal and the canaille tactic. He talks about the reconstruction of the fighting as the same as Billows does, but he stresses Greek performance, the slow, deliberate withdrawal of the Greek center without breaking ranks. So they were informed, according to Lacy, he would believe that they were informed, and I believe that as well, that at a certain point they will begin giving way, trying to lure them in. And of course, they would then halt, reform, do a 90-degree turn, and then both flanks charge the Persian center. Lacy believes these actions would have been impossible unless the professional force was not part of the plan. It's always a discussion about just what constituted a professional force, and I would assume it would be something that was very well trained. By comparison to most of the Persian troops, the Greeks certainly were a much more professional group. Credit for victory. He talks about the discipline of the Greeks, the professional army, and the fact that they are led by a seasoned general. The Persian army is not led by a lackey. He's an excellent general, but not he doesn't have the tools that he needs. He needs light cavalry, and that's not going to be used. Going to Krentz agrees that an army of amateurs could not have carried out such a plan, and he wonders just how professional the Athenians were. Now, Pericles bragged that the Athenians were just, you know, as brave without subjecting themselves to the rigorous Spartan training. Xenophon, years later, quoting Socrates, said that the Athenians have no public military training. Note, all would have been from the Peloponnesian War era. Now, that doesn't mean that the Athenians just sat around and then, oh, we're being attacked, grab your spear, let's figure out what we're going to do. They had to have some kind of training. It's just not the same as the Spartans. Herodotus says that the Athenian deployment resulted in a line equal to the length of the Persians, but only a few rows deep in the center. Of course, the Athenians didn't want to be outflanked. That's what he talks about. That's what the other people talked about. The Athenian right hugged the coastline, and the Plataeans were on the left, and they reached to Mount Stavrakaros. And so both wings are, you know, anchored on a physical spot that's really impossible to turn. The Greeks, of course, routed the Persian wings, then let them run off, and then moved to help the weakened center. So Herodotus' account makes sense, and most of this is simply agreed to by all of the other historians. The Persians were simply amazed to see the Greeks charging without either archers or cavalry, because the people that they were used to fighting used basically the same type of weaponry against them, or, you know, arms, if you will. All agreed to the battle end, that the Greeks made it through the hail of arrows. And then you had hand-to-hand combat, which obviously is a Greek advantage. We talked about that just in the length of the spears and equipment. Persian cavalry, if there, was unable to help. If there, it may have been actually on board ships that may not have had them all unloaded. Once the Persian flanks and center were broken, the Greeks pursued the Persians to their ships because they're trying to escape. Plutarch wrote that when Miltiades asked the Athenians for the honor of a crown of olive leaves, an Athenian shouted out, quote, "When you have fought and defeated the barbarians by yourself, Miltiades, then you may ask to be honored by yourself," end of quote. So everybody believed that it was a group victory, not an individual's victory. And you could put the individual monument up to the leadership, but it's a group victory. So that is the end of the little background on Marathon, looking at it through these various historians, including Herodotus, and then I've put my 2 cents worth in, since I haven't written a book, but I've covered a lot of material. So I hope you enjoyed this series with these books. I particularly like Krentz's book. I own it. I do not own the other individuals' books. Obviously, I have Herodotus's books, but at any rate, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, check out the souvenirs, And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.